This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
What's happening, family, and welcome to the In the Black of My Mind podcast. My name is Al Thomas, and I'm your host. So do me a favor and go down to the bottom of your page and click subscribe and share and tell everybody about this podcast. How many bodies? Everybody's. Tell everybody about the podcast. Today's guest is a musician, a recording engineer, a philanthropist, a businessman.
Wow.
And the proprietor, fix the lips. No, my father said, you fix your nose and your mouth won't work. So, well, that's a whole nother story. And the proprietor of a legendary institution.
Wow.
Carriage House Studios. Welcome to the podcast, Johnny Montanese.
Thanks, Al.
No, man. Thank you, man. How you doing, man?
I can't complain. And man, I feel like I could go home right now because that's the nicest thing anyone's ever said about me.
Oh, man. Don't even try it, man. I know everybody's always singing your praises. Man.
I don't know. I kind of tell them to kind of singing a little dull, a little flat, little this or that. I've made a lot of enemies in the music business.
You made a whole lot more friends than enemies,
well, thank
I'm sure.
You.
I'm sure.
Thank you.
Hey, listen, man. So, where were you? Where were you born?
I was born in Stanford.
Oh, you were.
I was born in Stanford on Richmond Hill.
Richmond Hill. Okay.
Yeah. Are you from Stanford originally?
Born and raised. Yes, sir.
Yeah. So yeah. I grew up on Richmond Hill. Yeah. You know the black and Italian neighborhood.
Yep.
My father had a garage, a repair shop that he ran.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother, she was the bookkeeper for the bookies. She held all the money till after the races, and then you went to Grandma's Nelly's house to get your money.
Oh, wow.
And so the term connected, yes, my grandmother was very connected.
Wow.
Went to Stanford High, went to St. Morris's for grammar school.
Hmm.
And then I left town about 69 or so, and then I was on the road for about 10 years playing drums.
Okay. Now, then who'd you play with?
I traveled a big show. That was my big break. I traveled with this Up With People show for a couple of years. I was all over the world, you know, Africa, Europe, South America.
Oh, wow.
Almost all the states. I was the drummer, had a big band in it, about a 12, 18 piece big band.
Wow.
It was a big show. It was a cast of about 100 people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I loved it. It was great, man. I grew up on playing that kind of stuff. It was kind of horn band stuff.
Okay. When did you start playing music?
I was running away from home at the age of 6 or 7. I was halfway down the driveway on Puritan Lane in Glenbrook.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know what happened, but I was done and I was leaving home. And my father said, hey, get back here. You want to go see a drummer? And I said, yes. So I came back. And at the age of around 7 or so, I started drum lessons.
Oh, wow.
And my father was a drummer back in the 40s, you know, being a auto mechanic, but he really loved playing drums.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was it. I started playing drums. And then when I was like, you know, who knows? I can't keep track of dates anymore. But, you know, when I was 8 or 9 or 10, my father used to take me to the Knights of Columbus talent show.
Oh, wow.
And he would set up a Victrola. You know what a Victrola is?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you're old enough. Okay, yes, so he set up a, exactly. He set up a Victrola, and he put a Buddy Rich record on, and I would play with the Victrola behind me. Mm-hmm. And then when it came to the drum solo, he'd shut the Victrola off, and I would drum solo, and then he'd skip ahead to the end of the song, and I'd play the end, and that's it. So that's how my showbiz career started.
Nice. Did you play in school at all?
Yeah, Stanford High. Well, you know, Stanford in the 60s, we had a drum corps, the Silver Falcons.
Oh, that's right.
That's right. And Malvin Claiborne.
Malvin and Dennis.
Malvin and Dennis, man.
Yeah.
Malvin, he beat the poop out of me, man, because he says, if you don't learn these drum solos right, I'm going to come down on you hard. And, you know, he was about 2 feet taller than me. And he was a tough guy. He was a tough guy. Yeah. And I used to go to my father and say, you know, Dad, Malvin's picking on me. He says, why is he picking on you? Because he says, I'm not learning the solos. He says, you better learn them solos. And so my father was definitely on Malvin's side and stuff like that. So yeah, my drum chops are because of Malvin and Dennis Claiborne.
Yeah, I got some stories about them guys, man.
Oh, we all, trust me. You know, I think one of the happiest moments we shared together is Sonny Rollins was here. The great saxophonist was here. We were working on the last record we did with Sonny.
Mm-hmm.
So Sonny's in the room, you know, eating his Cocoa Puffs or whatever, and his grapefruit and stuff like that. So I said, Malvin, come on in. I want you to introduce Sonny Rollins. So I introduced him to Sonny Rollins, and I said, it's how we had grown up playing drum corps together. And I said, Sonny, check this out. So I said, Malvin, let's play Boston Crusaders, that drum solo, because we used to memorize drum solos from other drum corps.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we hadn't played this in about 20 years. Do you know? We kicked it, man. It was unbelievable. Sonny was blown away.
Wow.
So I know that was one of the happiest days for Dennis and Malvin and I together. Yeah.
Wow. More wow.
Yeah. It's one of those moments, you know. You never think about those when you're struggling to build a studio and stuff that, you know.
Right,
it's amazing when, you know, somebody – I came back east in 78, and I took over my father's auto business. I don't know anything about cars other than the gas goes somewhere in the back. And so I ran the business for a couple of years only because it ran itself. You know, my father had employees with him that had been, you know, with him since high school and stuff like that. So once I got done – getting everybody settled, my mom, my brother, my sister, you know, somebody says, well, Johnny, what are you going to do? And I says, I don't know. You know, most of my music stuff has been on the West Coast and Denver and Chicago kind of stuff. And they said, well, why don't you build a studio? And I said, oh, man, that's a terrible idea. I hate the thought of owning a recording studio. So then I kind of weakened after a couple of guys talked to me. My good friend Kim Stickney, you know, who was up at MIT and New England Conservatory. So, you know, he said, yeah, why don't you do it? I said, you know, I played in all kinds of studios all over the country and in Europe. And so I said, okay, if I do it, I want it to be like on a farm where I don't have to worry about parking and stuff like that. So a friend of mine came to me and he showed me this property. It used to be a dairy farm from about 1820 to 1920.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, it had this woodworking shop in it and this and that. And I said, you know what, let's do it. So that was it. So for 2 years, we built it. And I was kind of working in New York City, managing an actress. Mm-hmm. And so I had some income there. And yeah, it took about a year to build the first room. And Meatloaf was my first client.
Wow.
Only because he lived like a block away from me and he needed a place to rehearse.
Oh, okay.
We didn't have any recording equipment, but we had this big room. Mm-hmm. And Meat said to me, hey, you know, let me rehearse. So Meat came here and rehearsed, and then we got to be friends, and one thing led to another. So we did work with Meat. So my earliest famous clients were like Meatloaf and Ozzy. We did a big mix with Max Norman and Ozzy, live at the Spectrum kind of a thing. Okay. But that's really how it started. And I think, you know, when I used to talk at Career Days, they don't hire me at Career Days anymore, you know, for the high schools.
Oh, yeah.
They used to say, yeah, get that guy from Carriage House. Let him come talk about recording studio business. And I would get up there and I says, okay, guys, forget about it. Don't do it.
Right.
Study welding, plumbing, or business.
Right. You know?
I says, because I get like two resumes a week from all over the country. People want to relocate. They want to work for free at the Carriage House. I says, you know what? It's so much mind draining for me to come up with things for you to do. You know, go get a good liberal arts education and go find yourself. But don't be studying recording institute, blah, 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 blah. It's that's not what you teach, is it?
No.
Good.
Public speaking.
That's why I got stopped. They stopped bringing me to Career Day because they were bringing me in to talk people into going into the business. And I told them, no, don't do it.
Right.
You know, if you haven't been playing guitar and you haven't been playing piano and you haven't really been in the music business since you were a kid, you have no business in the music business now, because nowadays there are a lot of people that have been studying guitar and piano and voice since they were kids. And those are the people you need in the music business. People that have it in their genes, genetically. Right. Their parents were music. Were your parents musicians?
My mom sang around the house. My dad played drums. Long story short, My dad was in the Air Force, and he was overseas, and he wasn't really a drummer. He could keep time.
Right.
And so he was in an NCO club, and the guys asked him, hey, man, why don't you sit in with us? And he said, I'm not a drummer. He said, no, well, look, none of these guys can keep time. And so he used to tell us all the time that if they gave him enough alcohol, he could at least keep time. And He played in a octet, and they traveled all over Europe. And the leader of the octet was Matt Guitar Murphy.
Oh my gosh!
And he said the for him the apex was his octet sat in with Count Basie.
Wow.
Yeah. And so he said, Count Basie's drummer is like came up to him and said, you know, show me something. He said, bro, show you the bottle of this alcohol. That's about it, you know. So he said that, but he was having a great time over in Europe and traveled all over Europe. And he wasn't going to never go. He wasn't coming back to the States. He had a month left to go, and they made him come back to the States to get out. And so he threw his cymbals in the Thames River, and he never played again.
Get out.
Yeah.
What part of the river? Because those are valuable symbols from back then.
Exactly.
Those are real Turkish symbols, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, my father used to take me in to see Louis Armstrong all the time. And we used to go into the city when they had the Metropole Club, which is now a gentleman's strip club. But back in the 60s, late 60s and early 70s, the big bands used to set up behind the stage there, and they would have Buddy Rich and Gene Krupa. My father was a huge Gene Krupa fan. In fact, when they opened Caldors in Riverside, Connecticut, Gene Krupa and his trio played like all day.
Really?
Yeah, I have a picture. I have a picture of me when I was this high with Gene Krupa, and my father. His garage, his repair shop was right down the street. So he told the guys, I'll be up at Caldor's all day if you need me and stuff like that. But we hung out with Gene Krupa all day. I think my father bought the meatball subs, you know, from Polici's. So we indoctrinated him with the Italian side of the Stanford committee here. So.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, my father used to say, when you play with the old timers, you got to make it sound like a bag of nickels, like you're shaking a bag of nickels. He says, if you can make it sound like a bag of nickels, you'll be in with the band. You know, so whenever I sat in with old timers, of which I'm one now, but when we'd sit in with the old timers, I always heard my father say, make it sound like a bag of nickels.
Nice.
The good stuff.
So when did you open up Carriage House?
So Carriage House, we opened in 1980.
Okay.
Go ahead, do the math. Go ahead.
No, the reason I asked is because we were. I remember we were one of the first people to record there.
One of my favorite records. One of my, it was like the Manhattan Transfer does gospel. Am I right or wrong?
Yeah.
It was harmonies, and it was.
Even before that, me, Robbie Jenkins, and Tanya, we had a group called Sweet. S-U-I-T-E.
Oh my gosh, that is really ancient history.
Yeah, so I mean that was like late 80s.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, late 80s.
So when did you do
A Better Way.
A Better Way.
Yeah, that was a little later on. Yeah, that was because we did Sweet, and then I came back and did something with Vincent Lynn.
Oh, Vinny, yeah.
Over there and Yeah, that's so wow.
I did a lot with Vincent. You know, here's the kickboxing champion of America.
Right.
And I'm telling him if he doesn't play it right, I'm going to take him out back and kick his butt. And he would laugh. And I said, yeah, I have old man strength. That is something you haven't planned for.
Exactly.
He was great.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He's got the life. He's a great kid.
Yeah. Did a bunch of movies and stuff.
Yeah.
And,
Yeah.
Played Carnegie Hall like three or four
times.
Yeah,
we saw him twice at Carnegie Hall. Mm-hmm.
So when I grow up, man. Now, so at what point did you realize that music was going to be your career?
When did I realize? I don't know. I was always the drummer, you know. Mm-hmm. I was in fifth grade and the nuns were dragging me around to play The Downfall of Paris and Three Camps, and I had my first rock band with Larry Chepeda in eighth grade, and we were playing Let's Spend the Night Together by the Stones, and my father run down to the bass and said, what the hell are you guys singing, you know? And I said, oh, that's just a song, you know.
We're
doing the Kinks and stuff like, but I've always kind of been in the, I've always done it, you know. Either I was pumping gas at my father's gas station or I was rehearsing, you know. I was playing in bars before I had a driver's license. My father used to have to drop me off, you know, in Portchester where all the bars were back then, and then the band would bring me home, you know, and stuff like that. So I've been at it since. I mean, when I was playing in bars, you know, you could smoke inside. That's why I never smoked. Because back in the 60s, people were smoking Lucky Strikes and Camels in the clubs, and it was unbelievable. And, you know, you had the go-go dancers on both sides of the stage, you know, shaking and stuff like
that.
And well, also, I was in the
secondhand smoke. So,
yeah, the secondhand smoke was terrible. But I've always been on that path. And then, you know, I was a terrible student in high school only because I was rehearsing all the time. You know, I was playing with a young artist, Philharmonic, you know, on Mondays with Sal Princiati, God bless him. And then I would be with Mrs. Motil at the Jewish Center Little Symphony. So I was with all the Guineas on Mondays and all the Jews on Tuesdays. And then Wednesday, we'd be doing, you know, Rolling Stones and the Kinks. And then Friday night was the church dances at St. Bridget's, St. Mary's, Star of the Sea. And then Saturday night, we played at the Woman's Club. And I think I slept all day Sunday. And then it started up again on Monday. So I've always been in the music business. I did not study music in school because my mom, she hated music. And she didn't want me to be a drummer like my father, you know. And so she wanted me to be an education, have an education and stuff like that. So I have a degree in child psychology.
Okay.
I have worked as a probation officer for juveniles and a juvenile officer. I was a truant officer for the state of Colorado in Denver.
Okay. Right, right.
Yeah, so I enjoyed that, but I still made my money because it didn't really pay well, that kind of a job.
Oh, right.
I mean, if you stay with it for 25, 30 years, you had, you know, all the benefits of working for the government. But, you know, I still was doing sessions and playing gigs and stuff like that. So it's all, I've always been in the music business. I never studied, you know, I was able to use my musical ability to get into college because I could not have done it academically. I was a dope, you know, I was not a academic kid in high school and stuff like that. So, but I leveraged my talent, to play, to get into certain schools, and it worked out, you know. I went to UCLA and I graduated from the University of Denver.
Oh, okay.
And so that's why I always felt when people ask me to go, when they want to go into the music business, you know, that they should, if they should study recording technology, that is a big fat no. Do not do it.
Wow.
Do not do it. Yeah. I mean, when I see people going down to Full Sail or going up to Berkeley, I know you're going to get banned now from the internet because I'm talking about the powerhouse Berkeley,
right.
You know, and, you know, when we were growing up, if you were going to go to Berkeley, you had to develop an ulcer first because you worried so much about the audition. Al, you got to go get juried at Berkeley. Oh, no, you're kidding me.
Oh,
the thought that you were going to go up there and play flute for them.
Right.
Would ruin your life for 6 months prior to the audition, right?
Oh,
nowadays, all you got to do is come up. Yeah, bring your flute if you want, but make sure you bring your checkbook.
Okay.
So.
Wow.
That's why I'm not invited on a lot of panels nowadays because, you know.
Wow.
In seriousness, you know, I just brought on a new guy who went to, I'm not going to say, but one of the Connecticut universities, 5 years, got a degree in audio technology, hasn't been able to find a job for 2 years.
Oh, man.
I said, why would you study that? Let's say I don't know for sure, but let's say there's 2,000 really professional studios. All right, how many do you think there are in New York nowadays? I bet you there's a half a dozen.
Yeah, mention of that. Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And so let's say there's a half a dozen in New York, and how many in Connecticut? There's probably two or three of us in Connecticut.
Right.
In Boston, there's probably two. You know, when you start adding them up, let's say there's 500 in America. Real professional studios. We're not talking about people with basements and laptops and stuff like that. We're talking about environments where they have real equipment and stuff like that. So then let's add up, how many graduates do we have from all these college programs?
Right.
Well, let's say in Connecticut, there's New Haven, and then there's Westcon, and there's this, and they're graduating, like, say, let's say they graduate 1,000. So Connecticut does 1,000, Full Sail does 2,000. So every year you have about 40, 50, 60,000 engineers.
Right.
Can't do it, man.
Right.
I always tell them, you study liberal arts, you study welding, you study plumbing, and then you work on your music.
Right.
But you're not going to jump into a music. You know, you could wind up editing. You know, we do Bush Beans here, the talking dog, you know. So, I mean, one of my guys who does all the big stars, you know, from Warren Haynes to Diana Ross, he winds up editing a talking dog. You know what I'm saying? So that's the kind of work you have to continue to do, you know, and we do all kinds of stuff here. And, but when it comes to an education, I don't look to people who graduated from recording schools and stuff like that. Really, it's not the way.
You know, I just had a flashback. I remember being down there, and you said, "Yo, man, I'll see you guys in a couple of weeks. I gotta go in here and clean out my medicine cabinet and restock it because Meatloaf's being here tomorrow." I was like, "Oh, okay."
Meat was cool, man. He was a great guy. He was bigger than life. I mean, seriously, his face was, he had this big round face. And he was always glad to see you, you know, and he was a good guy.
Oh, cool. I was in a couple of times. I started to come by there and I was like, man, I don't know, man. I was intimidated.
You're always welcome. You're always welcome.
I was intimidated, man. I was like, nah, I'm not going over there, man. Now, we were talking, you talked briefly about the fact that there's not very many studios in the area anymore. Mm-hmm. How did the pandemic affect you in the studio?
Well, we had a close down. I don't think we worked for 2 months.
Okay.
Right? So when did it hit? Like March, February, March?
March, yeah. Okay. March 2020.
So March and April, we did not do a single thing. And it was weird. You know, I don't have deep pockets, so, you know, it was nerve-wracking. We did get some government cheese. You know, the government showed up and dropped off a load of cheese. Mm-hmm. Ironically, I did not take the kind of money that a lot of people in my position did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think you know, where people were getting, you know, $100,000.
Right.
I got like less than a third of that.
Right.
Only because I was afraid I'd have to pay the government back.
Right, right.
So I was very cautious. I did not want to owe the government any more money than I did. So we were very cautious. So we didn't work for 2 whole months. And then when the New York studios were closed because of mandates, they shut them down.
Right.
A lot of people who had to do stuff started coming up here because we're kind of an open air. You know, we're a barn. We open all the doors, mm-hmm. and then we got involved with this COVID protocol bull. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're wiping everything down with these special cloths and, you know, bleaching the dog's paws and, I mean, all kinds of weird stuff.
Right.
And then, you know, one good thing, like Warren Haynes would come in. He had canceled a lot of concerts because of the pandemic. So he was doing like these private concerts here. So he'd come in and play guitar and sing. And if you had bought a ticket to one of his things, you would get, you know, you would get the stream of that.
Oh,
so we did a lot of that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we did not obviously go out of business, but I know a lot of people suffered tremendously financially during the pandemic. And then it started to open up a little bit more. We wound up doing more and more of work for like Juilliard. You know, because Juilliard, they couldn't use any of the studios at the school or in the city. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these people had quintets and quartets that they had to get recordings done.
Okay.
And so they would come up here because of the open airness of the place and our COVID protocol. So we wound up, so we did pretty well.
Okay.
You know, I mean, we didn't do pretty well. We survived the COVID thing.
Right.
So we survived it and stuff like that, you know. You know, my clients aren't really, you know, we do so much jazz. We do a lot of jazz. And I think that's because our heart is with the jazz musician. So we do whatever it takes for them to get their thing done.
Okay.
And as you know, we do a lot of gospel and Christian music, you know.
Right.
And those aren't necessarily the deepest pockets in the in the music business. I mean, I did make a lot of money with Rakim. You know, I worked with Rakim for many years.
Okay.
And, you know, I think we did 2 documentaries while Rakim was here, and they used to come up to me and they used to say to me, well, Johnny, what do you think of this rap music? And I used to take a pause. And I said, are you taking, do you see who I am? Do I look like a guy who gets in this car and goes to Z100 and listens to rap music? I says, I only do this because Rakim and I are good friends and he appreciates my musical ability to it, you know.
Right, right.
But he says, you know, to ask me if I really listen to rap music for 2-3 hours a day, no, that ain't happening.
Yeah, right.
Not unless it's in Italian, then I'll listen to it.
Is it jazz rap?
Or jazz rap, exactly.
Wow. You know, it's interesting because I've talked to a couple of drummers, man, and everybody loves the way you mic the drums over here. Your drum sound is like, as far as these guys are concerned, second to
none. I got goosebumps. Yeah, man. Thank you.
Yeah. I said, well, you know he's a drummer, right? He is?
Yeah.
Man. That's what you don't understand.
That's the biggest way to insult me is to not know I'm a drummer. I always tell people that. They say, you're a drummer? I said, oh, man, I am so insulted. On my gravestone, it says, "Here lies the drummer."
The drummer.
And so
that's right.
Yeah, but we are very lucky. We have, you know, Phil Magnotti. You know, him and I really started the studio together. Mm. He's a great engineer. In fact, I just talked to him 2 hours ago or so, and he's coming in with Keith Carlock, the drummer from Steely Dan and Sting and a couple other things.
Okay.
But we really learned from Phil miking and stuff like that. And also being a drummer, you know, I learned when a drum sounds great and when it doesn't. And you know, how much ring a tom should have, you know. You know, some people like to make them sound like Elton John, you know, 1970, hitting a cardboard box kind of thing. But we work with all the great drummers, you know, Vinnie Colaiuta, Weckl, Steve Gadd, Dennis Chambers, you know, a lot of great guys. Joe Morello, Take Five, Dave Brubeck.
Mm.
We used to do Dave Brubeck here. So we did a record with Dave Brubeck and Susan Tedeschi.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What a great, it was a title. It was a closing song on a film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was all Susan and Derek Trucks played guitar and Dave Brubeck played piano. It was spectacular.
Wow.
Those are the really great projects, you know.
Yeah.
The really fulfilling things, you know. We do a lot with the guy Ken Burns, you know, from public television.
Yeah. Yep.
So Brian Keene.
Yeah.
So Brian is the composer and arranger on a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
And Brian and I've been friends forever.
Hmm.
In fact, one of Brian's best records is this acoustic thing that we did together on quarter inch tape, if you can imagine that. And so we did 8 hours, 10 hours of recording to quarter inch tape. Mm-hmm. And then we spent the next 3 months editing all that stuff. And at that point, I almost killed Brian Keene because he was like, "Oh, you know, the little fit on my pinky. I want that from the third take." And I used to say, "Brian, I'm going to get a cup of coffee and I'm going to come back and you better have changed your mind about the little." But we have survived 40 years of friendship.
Right.
Me and Brian,
wow.
So.
Wow. Yeah. I met him through Marion.
Oh, yeah. Who I just spoke to 2-3 days ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Marion's moving back to the area.
Yeah. Yeah.
To Stanford. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he wanted to do a couple of things, you know, and, you know, what's that? One of my favorite songs of his is Dress to Cool. Dress to Cool. Yeah, to cool and stuff like that. But we all go back with Marion, you know, to like years.
Well, I grew up 2 houses down the street from him. So
no kidding.
Yeah.
In Stanford, though, right?
Yeah.
Where in Stanford was that?
On Bonner Street.
Bonner Street, sure.
Yeah, off of Selleck there, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we lived in Merle Avenue for about 10 years. And so then my father and his brother, they bought a duplex on Bonner Street. And so moving from the projects over there to that house, man, you couldn't tell me that we didn't move into the Taj Mahal. until I went to middle school with us up at Turner River and went to some kid's house up there in the Ridges. I was like, oh, wow.
Oh, welcome to Beverly Hills. Yeah,
exactly. People live like this?
Exactly. In Stanford.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, my first house, we lived across from the Civil War Cemetery on Greenwich Avenue.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So right there on the corner at the bottom of Richmond Hill.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so and then Malvin lived up Richmond Hill. On the left, to the left.
Oh, yeah.
And my grandma lived on Rose Park.
Rose Park.
So we all just grew up in that area, you know. And then
my father grew up on Spruce Street.
Yes, sure.
Yeah, so.
Those are the names of the streets. And then the drum corps used to rehearse at the Armory at the bottom of Richmond Hill. The Armory now is the Swiss Bank.
Oh, wow. Okay, okay. Oh, now I remember. Yeah.
There used to be the armory right on the corner there.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some of the Stanford has changed so much, man.
I
don't go down to Stanford that often anymore, but when I go through there, I look around, it's like, oh my God, man, this is, you know, especially like the South End, for instance.
Forget it. We don't even go to the South End.
They don't like even call it the South End anymore.
No, they call it the Astroland. The Jetsons live there. My son used to live there, right, E? My son's here. My son won't talk while I'm on the, but he's the technical guy. He really hooks all this up. So old fashioned, I can barely plug in a 3-prong electrical cord.
Man, please.
So I need young people for the technology and stuff.
I know, that's right. We need young people, period. Young people in the government, young people in business.
I agree. I agree.
You got these 80-some-year-old cats out here still trying to, you know, I was like, yo, man, you know, give it up, man.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I can tell you if it swings or not, but I'm not sure I can plug it in for you.
Right. Now we're talking.
Yeah, we just did a great record with Adam Holtzman, who played keyboards with Miles.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was a child prodigy. So when he was like 19 or 20 or 21 or something like that, he played with the Miles band. Mm-hmm. And then so Adam was in a couple of weeks ago with John Dorsman, who was the drummer for The Doors.
Oh.
So it was The Doors meets Miles. It was, you know, if people say, why would you build a recording studio? That is why. To get when you get those kind of guys into this facility, and the way the rooms are, and they were so comfortable, and the music was just fantastic.
Wow.
Just fantastic. Yeah. You know, everything was sketched out, but nothing was final. You know, nothing was set in stone. But the magic that's created when you get three, four human beings together and try and count off a number, and then they kind of groove to it. That's what I don't think AI will ever, not in my lifetime, thankfully, but
right.
It's the interaction of the personalities and the experiences that musicians bring together that still make it worthwhile.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're doing real music, if you're doing some of this other stuff that people want to call music, then AI that'll work.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But we see a lot of young bands, you know, we get a lot of young bands from the city, you know, in their 20s and stuff like that. And they're still doing it like the Beatles and Creedence did, you know, they're still writing the songs and banging it out at rehearsal. Yeah. And they come up here and they like the old equipment. They like seeing the big boards the tape machines. We don't record the tape anymore. I still do a lot of transfer for people who have 2-inch tapes from the 60s, 70s, and 80s and stuff like that. But basically the signal path, you know, from your microphone to the CD is about 80% analog here at the Carriage House. So a lot of times when we train a new engineer, a lot of the newer engineers have grew up on their laptop doing everything in the box.
Right.
Our biggest job is to help them learn how to do it on the analog, where you keep the music as electricity, and then at some point you transition it to the digital world.
Right.
But we try to work in the analog field as much as possible and stuff like that.
Oh, there's nothing like analog.
Yeah, no.
Nothing like analog.
You can't fool the brain. The brain gets it, you know. So, so did you read all those books behind you?
It's funny because.
Or is that just wallpaper?
No, man. When I was a kid, I used to be sick all the time.
Right.
And so books were my escape. That was my means by which I could go out and play. I mean, anything that came down the pike, it was like, you know, I had measles, I had the mumps, I had chicken pox, I had pneumonia, I had hepatitis. Anything that's like, you know, I'll take that. I was sick all the time. I was in the house. So all I did was read. So I have a voracious appetite for reading. So this bookcase behind me is probably about 12 feet wide, and it goes up to the ceiling. Mm-hmm. And I've probably read about 75, 80% of the books. And the ones I have, I read mostly biographies and autobiographies. Mm-hmm. I've always been interested in how people do things, you know, how did you get to where you are, and,
right.
you know, and, you know, that type of thing. So,
yeah, when I think when we first meet, when we, I meet a client, you know, for the first time, like Adam Holtzman, that's a good example. You know, I kind of asked him where he grew up, you know, and I want to know, I always want to know what your father did.
Right.
You know,
right,
I'm
right,
always
right.
curious, you know, my father was an auto mechanic and I did not turn out to be an auto mechanic, you know, and it's amazing when you ask him, oh, yesterday I was with, I met a woman and she's going to South Africa and traveling. And then she grew up in Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Norwalk listening to an opera singer, and I said, what did your father do in Stanford? And he was a janitor at Ripawam High School.
Oh, wow.
I says, you know what? I said, in the 60s and 70s? She says, yes, exactly. I says, you know what? I spent so much time at the auditorium in Ripawam doing summer musicals.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, because we all did Stage Door for Youth during the summer with Mr. Truglia and stuff.
Truglia.
I said, yeah. I said, I probably will recognize a picture of your father because we always, the janitors were always there, you know, and stuff like that. So, yeah, so I'm always interested, the backstory of somebody.
Man, it's the Truglia, man. Truglia was my clarinet teacher.
Get out.
Yeah.
What a great guy, right?
Oh, yeah, the best.
Just
solid. Bruce Monroe was my flute teacher.
Bruce Monroe.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did that Sing Out Stanford together. Bruce, and then who was the trumpet player? Ron. Who's the trumpet player? Bruce's best friend. Oh. Ronnie Ankrum?
I don't know.
Well, Bruce Monroe, he was like professorial, right? He was like a serious cat.
Yeah, 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 very much.
Unlike us.
Exactly.
Bruce was serious, right? And then Ronnie Ankrum, he became a teacher.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I'm surprised you don't know him, but he was a trumpet player. Bruce, what was Bruce's main thing? Flute.
Flute, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so. Yeah, those were great days when you could go to Ripawam High School all summer.
Yeah.
6 weeks. Mm. And they would have a music program there for free.
Mm.
You know, that's where I met Joe Corsello, the great drummer.
Oh, yeah.
And met a lot of people there.
Yeah, Joe used to come back and bring a quintet to the school to.
With Joyce, with Rick Petrone and Joyce D.
Rick
Camillo.
Rick Petrone. Well, he had, trying to think, there's this cat that played. Woodwinds, but his main instrument was baritone sax, I believe.
Oh, Joe Venuti.
Nope.
Joe?
No. But another guy that, but he was so tasty in the things that he did.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he used to bring these guys back and they would be in there wailing in the auditorium.
Yeah. Great musicians. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, in the old days, right. We used to do like so many demos for kids trying to get into college. You know, I would see kids playing alto and tenor, and then violinists would come in and flute play. All kinds of instruments would come from Stanford High or Ripawam.
Right.
And we would do the demos. You know, some of them we did pro bono, pro arte. You know, if the parents couldn't afford our fee, we charged $100 and there was no time limit, unfortunately. But, you know, because we didn't want the
philanthropy.
Whatever. Yeah. Hello, Connecticut Light and Power.
Exactly.
I want you to know.
Yeah, I'm a philanthropist.
We're going to shut you off if you don't pay your bill. So, we don't see that anymore. You know, we don't see I guess they're making it home. They make their own videos at home, you know, with their phones and stuff like that.
But. Right, right. But there aren't as many musicians. There aren't as many kids playing instruments is what I'm trying to say.
I blame it on the school system.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, definitely. I blame it on the school system. I blame it on the educators. I think they should ban sports from high school. There's man. A money killer, right?
Oh, man.
Please. Yeah, let's ban sports from high school. Mm. Then everybody will be in a marching band. We'll be like in Ohio where they have these marching bands of 500 people.
Oh, coming, exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
But that's what the, you know, society needs that in certain sections. You know, we need more music.
Definitely. I mean, well, it's already been proven that math helps with math and music helps with math and I just find it interesting because, as I said, there were so many kids playing back in the day. I remember playing in a battle of the bands, and when I was in high school, and there was like 15 bands in this battle of bands, and everybody was from Stanford.
Yeah.
I don't know 15 bands in Connecticut right now.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Back in the days when we used to do the dances at St. Bridget's and St. Mary's. I mean, every weekend there was a dance. Mm. And the thing about bands back then, son, is that when you joined a band, it was like a marriage. You were with that band till you died. So the fact that you're going to go play with somebody else is not going to happen.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, no,
you join, like our band was called the Extremes, and then we were the Spirits, and then we were the Living End. It was the same band, but we were together till death. Nowadays, a drummer's in like 6 different bands.
Oh, you know?
And there's no like loyalty. There's no gang mentality.
Yeah,
you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
And so, well, jazz is that way. Mm. You know, I think the reason why we became very relatively successful in the jazz world is that like many, many years ago, Rob Sylvan, you know Rob at all? Piano player?
I know the name.
Rob is like from New Haven, up around there somewhere. So he came to me and he says, I want to do a record. And this is like early on when we first trying to, you know, make music. And I said, oh, awesome, Rob. He says, yeah, I have $800. I need a week's worth of time. I said, okay, I don't care what the money was. I wanted to do the record. So I agreed to it. So about 2 days before the record, he comes to me and he says, you know what? I got some good news. I said, what? He says, I got Randy Brecker from the famous Brecker Brothers, you know, Blood, Sweat, and Tears and all that kind of stuff. He's going to come up and play 2 solos on this record. I said, that is amazing. He said, yeah. And he only wants $200 a solo. I said, wow, that's nothing. And then he said, yeah, but it's got to come out of your $800 because I don't have any more money. And so I agreed to it. I said, well, to get somebody famous up here like Randy Brecker
from
Blood, Sweat, and Tears and whatever, you know, the Brecker Brothers, you know. So Randy came up and he was, he was cool, man. He came up. He had his beatnik. He's not a hippie. He's a beatnik, you know.
Okay. Yeah.
He's a finger snapper, you know.
Yeah.
He's blowing his fugal horn into the corners of the build. So the record went great. So a couple of months or weeks later, Randy Brecker is with the late, great Jim Beard, who we just lost, the great arranger, piano player. Mm. And so Randy's talking to Jim Beard, and Jim says, well, where do you want to do your record? And Randy says, well, you know, I was up in Canada a couple of weeks ago. And Jim says, you went to Canada? And he says, yeah, it took me about an hour and a half to get there. And Jim says, you were in Canada? You were in Connecticut. Yeah, that's where I was. I was in Connecticut. And he says, well, where did you go? He says, I went to this place called, I don't remember the name of the studio, but they had a dog, a white dog with black ears, looked like the RCA dog. And Jim said, was the dog's name Toby? Yeah, it was Toby in Connecticut. Jim says, you were at the carriage house. That's where I was, at the carriage. Yeah, the guy had long hair. That was me, long, dark hair.
Yeah.
He says, yeah, that was John. Because Jim and I had worked on a project prior to this. So we became friends, you know.
Okay.
So Randy Brecker's talking to Jim Beard, and then, and so Randy says, well, let's do it up at the carriage. So Jim says, yeah, that'd be perfect. Because first of all, it gets Randy out of New York City and they can stay upstairs. And, you know, jazz records are only 3-4 days long at the most. You know, they're not like other records. So they came up here. So what happened was on Randy's, that record we did with Randy was called Toe to Toe. I still keep the record up on the wall here, because on that record was Anthony Jackson on bass.
Oh, wow.
Was Steve Gadd on drums. Was Mike Stern on guitar. It was all these like really famous people.
And
when I used to be invited to talk about the studio business, I used to say jazz is like a fungus, that if you do one jazz band, then the other guys are going to do a record, and then you're going to meet five more music, and then they're going to. So ever since that Randy Brecker record, we've done 15 records with Mike Stern, the guitar player. And then we've done a whole bunch of records with Anthony Jackson, the bass player, which include a lot of our stuff with Michelle Camillo. The Santo Domingo crazy man, the Latin pianist, And then all the other drummers came to us, you know, after Steve Gadd, Vinnie Colaiuta, Dennis Chambers, all those cats came to us. So that was one, that was a divine intervention where this one, I took the gamble. I took less money to do the famous guy, and we didn't screw up on the session, and and we've reaped from that for the last 40 years. I mean, to this day, we still do a lot of that kind of music.
Right, right. Yeah, that's awesome, man.
What do you really want to know about the Carriage House before we go?
Man, I mean, I'm here just listening, man. It's like, wow, man, because I know that if those walls could talk, there's some stories in there. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, we've famous clients, you know, I work with Miss Ross, Diana Ross, for almost 30 years. You know, I'm like her arranger guy, you know, we work with her on probably 8 or 9 records, mostly doing vocals with her. She has mixed when she was working with, I believe it was Ahmet Erdogan or somebody like that. He would come here and mix. But mostly all those projects were vocals kind of stuff. When she was working with Michael Walden, Narda, that was, you know, that was a great project. And then we worked with the late, great Donna Summers. You know, she was a local girl for many years. Did you work with Donna Summers?
No.
Oh, good. So, because we actually did some Christian music with her, and then we did some pop stuff with her. She was spectacular. When she sang in the room, it rattled the walls. She was spectacular.
Wow.
So her, and then Beyonce and the girls were here like 100 years ago. We did a whole. We did one pop record with them, and then we did a record for Oprah. Oprah wanted them to do a Christmas record, so we did the Christmas record here.
Oh, okay.
With Beyonce and those guys.
Wow.
And, but that's basically it.
Wow.
How about Bernard Jackson?
Yeah, I played golf with Bernard 2 days ago, on Wednesday. Yeah,
Out of here.
Yeah.
Does he still own a luncheonette? I remember he bought a luncheonette for his mom.
No, not any longer. He's just up. He's up this way. He's in. Where is he? He's in Wallingford. Yeah.
Surface, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, we were raised together, and my father was raised with his parents, and you know.
Get out.
Yeah. We go way back, man.
You got to give him a big hug and smack in the back of the head for me.
I'll make sure.
He came up here. I was like cutting the lawn or something, and he came up here, and he walked from around Stanford Hospital. He lived right, or did he live in Southfield Village?
No, he lived on near the village. Yeah, not in the village, but near. Yeah.
Yeah. So I remember he walked up here. He had a cassette. He wanted to play it for me. So, you know, I've been cutting the grass. So I said, okay, let's go. So we went into the studio. I listened to it. I said, Bernard, you sound like Michael Jackson. He says, yeah. I said, well, we already have Michael Jackson.
Right.
We don't need another Michael Jackson.
Right. Yeah, he figured it out, man.
Is he still doing albums. It?
He is. He's been just working on building his catalog and stuff, you know, because, you know, as you know, the whole the music industry has changed considerably and stuff. It's, you know, completely different. Everybody's really trying to figure it out, you know. He's got a couple of businesses that he's working now and stuff. And
cool. We'll tell him I said hello.
I most certainly will. I got a couple of rapid fire questions.
Sure.
Who are your musical influences?
Well, my father, definitely. Mm-hmm. You know, my father's the guy who dragged me to the Young Artists Philharmonic when I was like 10, 11, 12. And then I played at the Jewish Center Little Symphony. He would drag me to the Greenwich Civic Center to see Louis Armstrong and Buddy Rich and the big bands and stuff like that. And then, you know, I just got into I was a big fan of Blood, Sweat and Tears when that whole thing happened. And then me and my buddies used to go into the city to see the Cream, and we saw Hendrix at, you know, in the city and stuff.
Oh, really?
Like that. Yeah. So those were really my, you know, as far as any one genre, you know, being a drummer, whatever the gig was, I could play it. You know, I could play cha-chas all night. I could play, you know, Italian music all night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was really. I had a well-rounded environment. You know, as a teenager, we all did the Ripawam high school thing. So mm-hmm. we grew up doing West Side Story, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we did a lot of musical stuff as a kid. You know, mm-hmm. so I wasn't really confined to Beatle music or the Kinks and stuff like that. Also, yeah. Dixieland is my favorite, believe it or not.
Is that right? It's
because, yeah, I love Dixieland. And when I lived in Denver, Colorado, I play with the Queen City Jazz Band, which has been around since the 50s.
Hmm.
And I was like, you know, I was in my 20s and all the other cats were in their 60s, 70s, 80s and 90s, you know, but they had played with all the cats, you know. And when I was with Queen City, I played with Joe Venuti and Stumpy Malone, Earl Father Hines. These are cats you got to Google. You know, they've been around.
Well, Earl Father Hines is the only one of them that I know that you were, ones you just mentioned. Yeah.
And because, again, like my father said, make it sound like a bag of nickels. If you can play chikachu, 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 then you'll keep the gig, you know. So those are my influences.
Wow. You know, I'm embarrassed to say that I didn't know that Brecker played with Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
I think he did.
Hmm. I didn't know.
I could be wrong.
I didn't know about the Brecker Brothers until later on. They were doing. I first got into the Brecker Brothers when they were doing like Skunk Funk and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And they were playing horn parts for. Parliament Funkadelic.
Right, right. So I could be wrong about Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Mm.
I'm not sure.
What are your hobbies?
What are my hobbies? Plumbing. I go to the dump twice a week.
Nice.
I play in a church band, which I like. Mm. Steve Clark's the bass player. You know,
oh, really?
Steve?
What church?
We work for the Presbyterians in Old Greenwich.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, Steve's there. So we're kind of like the funkadelics nice. Of the Presbyterians of all the people in Old Greenwich. So hobby-wise, that's it.
Mm.
Cleaning the yard.
Right.
I don't bowl. I don't fish. I hate fishing. I hate boats.
Mm.
I
mean, I don't do any of those things either.
I don't play. My wife was a terrific golfer. Ruined her life because I don't play golf. None of my children play sports. They're all brainiacs. Wow. I forbid them to play sports in high school.
Mm.
And so no hobbies.
Okay. What is the greatest accomplishment of your life?
The greatest accomplishment of my life?
Yes.
Well, first of all, I got up this morning, so I think that's, at 70, when you get up and you see the sunrise, and then I go right out onto my deck outside my bedroom, and I sit there in front of the sun from about 7:15 to 7:45. And I think I am at total peace with the Milky Way and beyond. And then after that, the shit hits the fan.
Yeah, right, right. That's it.
And then I'm serious until 10 o'clock that night. And then I sit down and yes, I will either have a glass of wine or a tall glass of Jack Daniels. Mm. And then I go to bed and the routine starts all over again. Yeah. I think my greatest accomplishment, I lucked out with children. Mm. So I have great children.
Yeah. As do I. Yeah. And I've been blessed. What's on your bucket list?
On my bucket list? Mm-hmm. Okay. You may be surprised, but my bucket list only extends out 12 hours at a time. So today on the bucket list, once I finish this, I have to raccoon-proof my chicken coop because I'm down from 10 chickens, I'm down to one chicken.
No.
And I'm going to catch that MF-er who's been killing my chickens. And I'm going to make gloves or sneakers out of them. But so on my bucket list, after I'm done with you, I'm going to go to the dump, say hi to all my buddies at the dump, because they are my friends. Mm. And then I'm going to probably board up the entry that this raccoon's getting into killing my chickens.
Okay.
And then my son and I, while I'm at the dump, he's going to go through the this big console here, look for little problems. Mm. And then at some point around 3, I'm driving into New York City to pick up my technician who really knows how to work on these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so we will be with him from about 4 till 8 o'clock tonight.
Okay.
Then around 8:30, I will drive him back into Manhattan, drop him off on 48th and 10th. And then I will come up the west side not on the highway, because I'll drive up the west side and then I'll pull over and get a slice of pizza.
Okay.
And probably get a Diet Coke. And then I will hop on the Hudson Highway. Aren't you glad you asked my bucket?
I'm sure.
And you know what? To be honest with you, that's the extent. And then tomorrow, Arthur Lipner's in tomorrow. You know Arthur?
I do not.
He's vibe player and marimba player.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So tomorrow Arthur Lipner's in at noon.
Wow.
It's going to be piano, bass, and jazz vocal. It's going to be one of these highbrow kind of things.
Okay.
That only Arthur does.
Mm.
And then Sunday we start a big record with a band called Wunderbar. They're from Boston.
Okay.
They're like an alternative band. You know, we've done a lot of alternative music here.
Mm-hmm.
So the engineer is a girl, and she's coming in from London. So she'll be with us for a week or so.
Mm.
And so she's going to come in. I always invite the engineer to come the day before, and I make it available to them so they can learn the environment and meet the chickens and Heather and the dogs and everything.
Right, right.
So they really feel comfortable here. So we give the engineer producer time to come the day before, even before the band arrives, and sort of settle in and stuff like that. So that's really it. I mean, I'd love to go to Italy again. Heather and I went to Italy many, many, many years ago with Pat O'Shaughnessy, who taught at Norwalk High School, who's a history guy. But other than that, you know.
Mm. You know, which leads me to my next question. Where's the coolest place you've traveled to?
The coolest place?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, being an old Italian Catholic, Rome was unbelievable.
Really?
Yeah. So we really were treated very well in Rome. I had worked for the Legionnaires of Christ doing music for them.
Mm-hmm.
They actually have a big... rectory or school here in Connecticut, up in around Cheshire and in New Hampshire. So when we were going to go to Italy, I called them up and I says, "Hey, che fa? I'm going to Italy. I need keys to the Vatican, you know." So they set us up with that, and they gave us a great tour of the Vatican. So,
oh wow,
that was one of the great trips I think I ever made. I had traveled a lot. I'd been all over South America and Europe. But the most memorable thing was our time in Rome
nice.
With Heather, my wife, and Pat and Linda.
Nice. Who's your hero?
Who's my hero? I don't know. You know, I'm a sucker for the common man. You know, I always think of, it's funny you should say that, because you know who came to mind? The guy who jumped in the water in Washington, D.C. to save the life. Remember when that plane went down into Potomac?
Right,
that happened how many years ago? 25 years, 30 years ago?
Yeah.
There was a guy who jumped in the water and saved a passenger, and he wound up dying himself. That's my hero.
Wow.
You know, guys who get up and went to fight the war. I mean, I have so many friends came back, you know, damaged goods.
Yeah.
And how we disrespect their lives nowadays. That's a tough topic I could scream from the rooftops about.
Yeah, I'm a veteran, and so you know, I remember being over in Korea, and I was at a friend of mine over there who functions really well during times of war, but peace times he struggled.
Yeah.
And you know, because he just had been seen too much, experienced too much, and they weren't helping him, you know.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate, man. You know?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because my motto will be, when next time somebody asks me that question, I'm going to say it's the common man.
Wow.
That is really my hero.
Yeah.
You know, not famous people, actors. Oh, actors are definitely not my heroes. You know, even musicians. You know, but you take a guy like you. You went and served. I didn't serve. I was in the first lottery. You know, that came out. So I think my number was 285, and they were only taken up to 180.
Oh wow!
But I did work for the USO for 2 years. You know, we used to fly out onto aircraft hangar. You know, large ships. We toured all the bases in North Africa and stuff like that.
Wow.
But, you know, but then it's a cush job. I didn't really suffer through any of that. But I had a friend of mine that I traveled on the road with who was a military policeman in Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
And he had to sleep at night. He had a quarter inch cutout of a gun, of his whatever the gun he carried. And he had a piece of metal cut out to look like that gun, polished. And he had to sleep with that under his pillow when we were on the road.
Oh, wow.
Because when he would go to bed at night, he could not sleep soundly unless he could feel the gun under his pillow.
Right. Wow.
And he didn't want to freak me out by having a gun under his pillow. So he had this gun, you know, I think it was even painted pink or something like that, you know, not to scare anybody, but yeah, I mean, that is really
wow. What's your favorite song?
Sunny Side of the Street.
Okay,
next question.
Who's your favorite group?
My favorite group? I think my favorite genre is like Yes. Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Chicago. You know,
Rick Wakeman.
And also, you know, I'm a big fan of Leonard Bernstein. I've been watching a lot of his videos of him conducting the London Symphony and stuff like that. I mean, I'm a big symphony orchestra guy.
Okay.
So,
Daryl Tuke spoke highly of Bernstein.
Yeah, I thought the movie was terrible. The Bernstein movie? Yeah, I thought it was awful.
Wow.
But I think him as a, you know, he was freaky deaky, but he was a great conductor and a great musician. And, you know, you could say the same thing about Michael Jackson, but you know what? You can't take it away from him.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Tell me your life story in one sentence.
I grew up in Glenbrook. I was a great drummer. I was one of the greatest drummers ever to come from Stamford, Connecticut. And I will be buried at St. John's Cemetery in Springdale.
Wow. Deep. You know, how can people contact you on social media?
They contact me. They can just go to johnny@carriagehousemusic.com or go to Carriage House Studios, Stanford, and click on donate money. Click on whatever my son put there to click on.
Cool. Johnny, I know you got stuff to do. You got to make your runs to the dump and take care of the dump chickens.
Right.
So, but you know, man, I'd like to thank you, man, for doing this, man. I really appreciate it, man.
Anytime. You're a joy to see again, and I wish you all the best.
I appreciate you, man. More than you know.
Take care.
All right, you too. Peace.
Bye-bye.
This has been another episode of In the Black of My Mind podcast. Make sure you like, comment, subscribe, and share. Until next week, y'all be blessed.